This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, April 27th, the Bible Movies edition. I'm Gabriel Roth, an editor at Slate, and the dad of Eliza, 6, and Leo, who's almost 3.
My name is Carvel. I am a freelance writer, and I am the father of Ezra, who is 14, and Georgia, who is 11.
Rebecca is on vacation with her family this week. She'll be back with us next time. This week, we're going to answer some questions that listeners have written in to us over our email address, which is momanddad@slate.com. If you have questions that you would like us to wrestle with, you should also email us at that address, momanddad@slate.com. Then for Slate Plus members, you're going to hear Dan Coyce, former host of this show, give a report. He's finished the first leg of his family's round the world sojourn. They're leaving New Zealand. They're moving, I think, to Holland. Hear how things went in New Zealand from Dan Coyce on the Slate Plus segment of the show. If you're not yet a Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/momanddadplus or by downloading our iOS app. Search for Slate in the App Store or go to slate.com/app and get 90 days of Slate Plus absolutely free, including the chance to hear Dan Coyce's trip report. Okay. And if you haven't yet liked us on Facebook, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. That's enough announcements from me. Let's go to triumphs and fails. Carvel, do you have a parenting triumph or fail for us?
Well, I think it's a fail, but I'm not 100% sure. And this is kind of serious. So I'm going to tell you about something that's going on right now in our family's experience, which is that this has to do with the rising cost of living in the Bay Area and some of the changes that's forcing on our family. So just yesterday, a report came out on a local station that reported that now, as of this last report, Housing and Urban Development has listed six figures for a family of four as officially low income in the Bay Area. So if you have a family of four and your income is $104,000, you are now officially low income and qualified for low income housing in the Bay Area. That's how crazy it's gotten here. And last year I got evicted from, I had this great 3-bedroom apartment in Alameda that was, that I paid something like $2,000 for, and it was this old place, and the landlord loved us and blah, blah, blah. And I rented my place out on Airbnb while I was traveling for work, and I didn't even think about the rent, the like legal ramifications of it. And then I came home, and my landlord, who had always been super kind to us, had an eviction notice on our door. And so ended up leaving that place, and then I found out that place then went on the market for twice what I was paying for it. And so my kids then moved in 100% with their mom, and we worked out this crazy arrangement where I spend 4 days a week over there, and she travels and so on and so forth. And then their mom just got word that her landlord is selling the house, raising the rent by $500 until she sells the house, and then is selling the house. And their mom, who currently makes six figures, can't afford another 3-bedroom in the Bay Area. And so there's this tremendous question about what we're going to do as a family, because we both allegedly did what you're supposed to do as an adult. Like, we both went to college. We both have good jobs. I'm supposed to be this writer. She worked for this company. Like, everyone's doing what you're supposed to do as an adult. And yet we're not finding it possible to operate in the Bay Area. And so we're kicking all these different options around. And I'm like, we should move. Like, we can't afford to live here anymore. And she's like, but then we can't uproot the kids and go take them to some random other part of the country that they've never been in and suddenly ask them to start life all over again at ages 14 and 11. And at this point, there's doubt about how to handle that. I'm sort of advocating, let's go back to the East Coast. It's actually cheaper to live in Manhattan right now than it is to live in Oakland, which is insane. I mean, people in Oakland are leaving the city in caravans. And yet she's like, well, I mean, how are we going to uproot kids who have been born and raised in California and suddenly like drop them off in New York City at this age? And is that, and so we, I don't, at this point, the question of a failure is, there's so many things, parts along this where I feel like if I had just done this, if I had just done that, if we had never moved to the Bay Area, if we had stayed in New York, if we had gone back to whatever small town or whatever. But then right now in this moment, there's like, I literally don't know how to handle this with my kids. My son wants to move to New York. He loves it there. He thinks it's a big, exciting thing. My daughter has no interest in that. She's like, I don't want to leave my family. And their mom is 100% certain that she's not going to uproot right now. And at this point, we don't really know what to do. So I feel as a parent, some sense of, I don't know if failure is the right word, but it's in that category of like, I don't have an answer for this and I don't know the right way to deal with it.
Yeah, this isn't a failure. This is a problem. It's a terrible problem.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How have you presented it to the kids so far? Like when the second eviction notice came, when their mother got the eviction notice, how did you communicate that information to them?
Yeah, well, technically there hasn't been an eviction notice. There's just been an announcement that the owner intends to sell, but we sort of know what that means. She's not going to be able to buy the house. She looked into that, but it was like going to be insane. And so we were pretty straightforward. Like, this is the deal. And I mean, kids raised in Oakland are raised knowing about gentrification and rising housing prices from the moment they're born, because it's all anyone talks about out here. So this was not a new concept to them. So the plan is that is for their mom to move in. Actually, her boyfriend has this huge 3-bedroom house over by the lake, and that he's had, he doesn't own it, but he rents, but he's had incredible rent stability for years and blah, blah, blah. So her first plan is like, I'm going to move in there with the kids. They have 3 huge bedrooms and that's going to be fine. They like him. I like him. He seems like a good guy. So the kids are of mixed feelings about that. My son is like kind of lukewarm about that, but gets it. My daughter's excited because she's just like, oh, I'm going to get a new room and I get to decorate it this new way. And my son's happy it'll be closer to where his friends live. And so everyone's sort of dealing with it. There doesn't seem to be as much anxiety about it as you would think. I mean, it sounds like one of those things where you're like, everything is terrible, but the kids are sort of aware that things happen in life. It doesn't mean the end of our family. So they seem to be dealing with it pretty well. I think she's dealing with it pretty well, although I know that there's like layers and layers of stress about it. I feel like I'm dealing with it pretty well because I already went through this last year, and now this is her first time sort of having gentrification come right to her kitchen and like remove stuff from her fridge, and that happened to me really last year. So I feel like no one seems to be panicking or in a state of incredible discomfort. But there is a sense of not knowing if we're handling this the right way, and a sense of that if we don't handle it well, the ramifications could be that we'll live to regret it, if that makes sense.
It seems like now there's a lot of weight being put on their mother's relationship with her boyfriend, right? Like that becomes one of the important questions now.
Yes. Well, one of her thinkings, and I actually think that this logic tactically makes sense, is she's like, look, We they've been together like 4 years, 3 years. She's like, look, we're going to give this a shot. If it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, I'll basically be in the same situation that I'm in now, just like a year later. So in some ways, this is a good opportunity to see what happens, which I actually think makes kind of sense.
And then you would get a place on your own nearby?
Yeah, I'd have to figure out how to do that. I mean, we're all close by geographically, so that's not really an issue. But, you know, for me, like, I'm trying to figure out how to get back into a 3-bedroom somewhere. And that's tricky. That's like not easy anymore in the Bay Area. We don't really know what the future holds. But the good news is, like, as a family, we've been through not knowing what the future holds a lot. So I think we're pretty adept, the four of us, at handling this. But I think the main thing that I don't know is if I'm, part of me feels like I should be advocating much harder that we leave the area.
Why do you feel?
Because I think that maybe that's the only, like, for her, that's just out, end of story, no question about it. And I'm like, but why is that out? Like, the life that we want isn't available for us here. Even though everyone's working, like, everyone's doing their job. Everyone works 40 hours a week. You know what I mean? Everyone is, like, doing their thing. And yet it's not possible for us to, like, organize a life because the Bay Area is just so bananas right now. And so I guess that's why I feel that. But yeah. I don't know if that's right or not.
Yeah. I mean, this is what everyone in these big coastal cities is having to figure out right now, right? Everyone without a crazy finance job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I hope you figure out a great solution and one of those magical real estate solutions drops into your lap, as occasionally happens. Keep us posted.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. And I'd be interested in hearing, too, what people share on the Facebook page and in the community in general, because I think that this is something that, like, is relevant to a lot of what people are experiencing right now, which is this weird feeling of, you did all the stuff that you were supposed to do to be an adult. Like, you went to college, you got a job, you work consistently, and yet somehow still finances and just having a legitimate real estate life eludes you now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of people are experiencing that. So I'd love to hear other people's thoughts, feelings, and experiences with that.
And also, if you have moved kids from one city to another, how did that go? What were you afraid of, and how did it work out? Especially yes. older kids, like younger teenagers, like Carvel's kids. How did that go? I have never done that with kids. I've moved across the country several times before my kids were born, but now it's a completely different question.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I don't have a crisis like that, fortunately. I just have one of those ordinary, everyday failures. Yeah, that's all I have. this is actually a failure that's, like, it hasn't happened yet, but I have, like, meticulously put all the pieces in place for a failure. So now it's just a matter of watching the train of failure come rolling down the tracks. I'm going away for work later this week. I'm going to Canada for, like, 3 days to speak at a conference. And I don't usually travel for work very much. And so my kids aren't used to it, and nor does my wife. And so, you know, we've each been away, like, once in their lives. And so I very carefully, like, laid it out for them. You know, later this week, I'm going to be going out of town for a few days. And so I'll miss you a lot, and you'll miss me too. But then I'll be back, and we'll see each other again, and I'll be so happy to see you, and like that. And it was okay. Eliza was a little, like, she gets very upset when anything like that is about to happen. And so I spelled it out for her very carefully. I'll be here this day. I'll take you to school this day. Then I'm going to get on this plane. And then 2 days later, I'm going to get on another plane and come back. Not a big deal. And of course, I say to her, and when I come back, you know, I hear sometimes they have things for kids in Canada, and maybe I'll bring you a little something in my suitcase, which is the sort of standard operating procedure when you go on a trip, right? You bring back something mm-hmm. for the kids. And she Absolutely. Latches onto that. And immediately she says, so what is it going to be? Is it going to be, and she begins like a Barbie dream house Uh-oh. Or whatever. It wasn't that specifically, but it was whatever is her contemporary equivalent of the Barbie dream house. No, it's probably not going to be a Barbie dream house. Is it going to be we're not discussing what it's going to be. It's going to be a surprise. The surprise is what you say when you don't have an answer. Right. And so now every sort of 2 or 3 hours, she'll ask something like, do they have My Little Pony in Canada? Just apropos of nothing in particular. Just curious whether the My Little Pony line of products has made its way over to Canada. So now there's nothing I can, like, what I'm thinking is literally, like, what I had been thinking is literally like a stuffed moose from the Toronto airport. You know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely.
Like,
of course.
A medium sized stuffed moose with a like maple leaf thing on.
Yeah.
And now, like, oh man, that is just not going to cut it anymore. So I don't know what to do. Man. I will probably wind up getting her the stuffed moose and a candy bar. We'll see how that goes. But so, I have set my children up for bitter disappointment.
How old?
She's six. She's six, she's at an acquisitive stage.
Yeah, you've committed the classic blunder right there, which is you've stated that you have a surprise, that you intend to be small, and that in a child's imagination, the word surprise only means you're bringing me a literal Corvette, drive like a pony driving a Corvette, basically, is what I expect.
That's exactly
anything
right.
Less than that is going to be a disappointment. So, probably what I would do in your situation is I would begin to downgrade. You know, I begin to expectation manage.
Yeah.
Going, you're like, you know, they do have a lot of things there, but I'm not going to be able to carry something really big on the plane.
Suitcase isn't very big. Yeah, classic. Suitcase
or whatever. So I think it'll probably be something small.
Yeah.
And
small, but very pretty. Something small, but really pretty. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, it changes from, like, Leo is like 2 3/4, almost 3. And like, now if I say a surprise, he's excited for the surprise. And if I give him a moose, he'll be excited about the moose. Like, whatever it is, he hasn't yet, he doesn't have the mental capacity to form an expectation of what the surprise will be.
Right.
But I didn't realize that she's crossed that line to where you say surprise, and now she has like 7 incredibly specific products in her mind. Yes. Like, she could tell you like the barcode SKU of each of the My Little Pony products. And if it isn't all 7 of those, then it's going to be an incredible disappointment for her. It's a moving target, this stuff. It sucks.
It is. But you're right. You've set up for a failure, but I think it's not too late to dig yourself out.
I hope not.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, let's get to our first question from a listener. We got this question over email. So the voice you're going to hear reading the question is not the voice of the person who sent us the question. I have to be very clear about that. It's the voice, rather, of June Thomas, who hosts Slate's The Americans podcast.
My husband and I are not religious types, but our relatives are. They give our children Bible storybooks, stuffed animals that recite prayers, Bible verse t-shirts, and recently, for Easter, a bunch of Christian movies. I've never particularly minded. My first grader has an interest in reading the Bible, so maybe he'd enjoy these movies. I'm worried because he's old enough now that these lessons can sink in. Lessons like God only lets certain kinds of people in heaven, the brutality of the cross, men are better leaders than women, obedience to God is the highest value, etc. I feel I should screen these movies before I let the kids take it in. But really, who has the time for that? What do you think? Should I trash them? Should I supplement these films with a kid version of the Quran? Thanks for your thoughts.
Okay, thanks, June, and thanks to the listener who wrote in with that question. Carvel, what do you think?
Ooh, man, that is, that's complex. I mean, I tend to be a little more accepting of religion conceptually, even organized religion, than most people I know, even though I'm not myself a member of any church or anything of the sort. But so I'm not initially or kind of like inherently revolted by the concept of someone introducing biblical concepts of Christianity to my kids behind my back. I know that really triggers some people, and I think that's understandable. I don't personally have that, but what I hear underneath this question is really just the basic question that all parents have, which is the regulation of media, right? Like, people are ideas and concepts are coming to our kids through the media. And whether it's like adult content, or whether it's like misogynist stuff or racist stuff or violence or whatever it is, and how do we account for the fact that they're going to be getting stuff behind our back that we can't control all of? And so I guess advice wise, the question that I hear in there is like, should I like screen all this stuff or should I just throw it all out? And my guess is that it's not possible to screen all of it. I think you should screen as much as you can, even if it's after the kids have watched it, right? I don't know that you need to like make yourself the kind of quality assurance manager that it has to go through you before it gets to them, because I think that's just kind of impractical. But I think it's always good to be on the same page with your kids about whatever media they're seeing. You kind of want to watch it with them or after them so you can talk about it with them. And it's fine if kids hear concepts like, I mean, and again, not these aren't even really Christian concepts, but they may come through Christian media. But like, if kids hear things that are disturbing, I don't think that that's necessarily a problem, as long as a parent is there to say, hey, I know this is on your mind. Do you have any questions about it? Here are some thoughts I have about it. You know, these are some of the values that we like to believe in this family, and the kids can make their own decisions. I don't know that it's necessary to just throw things out wholesale because you think there may possibly be something in there that may be a little difficult for your kid to manage. That's one thing. The other thing is I think it's so interesting that this person didn't talk about talking to the parents about this, like saying, hey, you know, when you give our kids like all this like biblical paraphernalia, it puts me in a difficult position. Can you maybe slow down on that? So there's some reason why the person, why that wasn't an option that they asked about. And I don't know what that is, but I would also recommend that too. Like, that's a conversation adults should have. Like, you're putting a lot of stuff into my house that I'm not quite ready for. Can we kind of slow the roll on that? But outside of that, I think that if the kids are interested, let them explore it and just be sure that you are up on what is in that content at some point, either before or after, so that you can sort of parent accordingly.
Yeah, I think I'm going to take a firmer line on this than you are. I should start by saying I'm not a religious person. I don't come from a religious family, but I did go to Christian schools. I grew up in England and I went to Church of England schools, and I got a sort of generic Christian education. And it didn't bother me. And in some ways it was culturally enriching. And when I was a kid, I definitely had like kid Bibles and Old and New Testaments, and I enjoyed them. And I think it occupied a pretty similar role in my childhood life as like the Book of Greek Myths. You know what I mean? Like, here are some really cool stories.
That's a good analogy.
And right. once you know those stories, if you don't subscribe to that religion, you see those stories pop up again and again as you get older, like in all literature and all culture. Yeah, it gives resonance to all kinds of experiences, and that's great. And it helps you understand all kinds of things about the world, and that's great. In this case, it seems like from the letter writer's description, it seems like what we're talking about is a particular form of contemporary Christianity that is different from what I experienced growing up, and that sort of contradicts the letter writer's values in a pretty firm way, right? And would also contradict my values, quite frankly. God only lets certain kinds of people in heaven. Well, most Christians, I think, believe some version of that. That's probably wrong, and I shouldn't speak for Christians. But the brutality of the cross, like, yeah, okay, violent stories. But there was a violent story where, like, Kronos eats his children in my Greek myths book. Mm-hmm. I liked that one. But then men are better leaders than women. That is not very good. Obedience to God is the highest value. That is also unfortunate. There are forms of media that are essentially propaganda for a worldview that I find pretty abhorrent, and that are propaganda directly aimed at children. And I suppose you could argue that I let my children watch all sorts of commercial propaganda for My Little Pony toys or whatever. And that might not even be wrong. But when you're faced with something that really espouses a worldview that really is the opposite of what you want to teach your children, I think my move would not be to let them watch it and then address it with them afterward in that case. I think my move would be to like quietly get rid of it and not give them access to it. And as they get older, they can experience more and more parts of the world, including things that I find abhorrent and reprehensible, and they can do with that what they want. And I think it's unlikely that they will grow up to become, you know, Christian misogynists or doctrinaire right-wingers or whatever. But if they do, then that's their prerogative.
Well, part of the thing that was interesting is that, so this has to do with the way we interpreted the way the person wrote the letter. Because you didn't read it closely enough, but I didn't hear that that was actually what was in the content, more that that's what the letter writer was afraid and assumed was going to be in the content, right? But I don't know that the letter writer was like, yeah, I saw this stuff and it was like, men are better than women. And I was like, what should I do about this? Like, you know what I'm saying? So I think that not all Christian material is like that. Some is and some isn't. And I think the question that this letter writer is facing, and again, maybe you know more about what type of Christian media is implied by this letter than I do. But I don't know what type of Christian media is implied by this letter. It sounded like what the person was saying was, I'm getting this Christian stuff and I'm afraid it's going to be all these things.
Yeah.
And I want to screen it, but I don't know if I have time to screen all of it. And so I'm like, yes, screen as much as you can, but also like recognize that you don't have to like sort of pick through every single piece of media like it's, you know, like you're picking stones out of black beans in order for your kids to watch it. At a certain point, more information is going to come to your kids, and you just sort of want to be in the, I think you just sort of want to be in the general neighborhood of stuff that they're getting so that you can talk about that stuff as it comes up. But
yep.
I mean, yeah, if someone was like, hey, I got this DVD about how men are the reflection of God and women are the servants. I would be like, actually, you need to get off my porch right now. You
know what I mean? Here's some Nazi propaganda for your children. It'll keep them entertained the next time you need to do housework. No, I guess my assumption is, because the letter writer says, my husband and I are not religious types, but our relatives are. So I assume that mm-hmm. she and her husband are, to some degree, familiar with the particular sure. Christian culture that this stuff is coming out of.
Right.
And that she can sort of assess with a reasonably high degree of accuracy, like, mm-hmm. what is being pushed in these particular movies. And right. I also think, frankly, you could probably tell a lot by reading the jacket copy on these DVDs, right? Like, you can tell, mm-hmm. like, horrible sexist Christianity from pleasant, benign Christianity pretty mm-hmm. easily. They don't usually try to, maybe they do try to disguise them. I don't know. In any case, I think the bottom line is, like, you definitely have no obligation to your kids or to your family members to, like, allow them to watch movies that you think are reprehensible. In the exact same way that I wouldn't let my yes. kids watch pornography or watch violent horror movies. And in the same way that your Christian relatives, I'm sure there are plenty of movies that your Christian relatives wouldn't want their children watching.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to exercise that same prerogative.
Yeah, but I always wish I could like ask the letter writer more questions, but I still wonder why. I want to know more about their relationship with these relatives, right? Are these like just the crazy relatives who live in a Christian compound and are probably going to get into a gunfight with the FBI within the next couple of weeks? Or
do not let them babysit.
Do not let them babysit. I think we covered that 3 episodes ago.
No sleepovers. no sleepover at the compound.
But, you know, unless your kids are trained for firearm safety. But if it's not that, then it's like, I always feel like that's the first stop, right? You have to go to these adults and say, hey, look, I really appreciate you reaching out to my kids and wanting to connect with them. This is a bit much for us. Can you dial that back a little bit? You know, and I just think it's interesting, but I don't know why this is the case. But I think it's interesting that that was one of the options that was not addressed or asked about in the letter. It's like, should I let them watch it? Should I not let them watch it? Should I screen it? Not should I tell these people to stop sending my kids this stuff that I find so morally reprehensible?
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. If you are listening and you are a Christian or a participant in Christian culture, what did we get wrong? How wrong are we? Tell us how wrong we are on our Facebook page, or maybe we're not wrong in any way. That's what I think. let us know on Facebook, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting, or email us at momanddad@slate.com.
Nickelodeon's got your preschoolers covered from sunrise to bedtime with 4 brand new podcasts. Grab their backpack and go on a culinary quest with Dora's Recipe for Adventure. Make game time great time with Let's Guess Who with Josh and Blue. And tuck in for adventure with Nickelodeon's Goodnight Bedtime Stories. Plus, we've got a brand new season of Storytime with Josh and Blue. Search Nickelodeon on your favorite podcast app to listen.
Okay, on to another one of your letters. To read this letter, again, we have not the letter writer herself, but instead Mary Wilson, producer of Slate's daily news podcast, The Gist, with Mike Pesca.
And the letter reads, hi, here's a fun question. Our 7-year-old daughter and 5-year-old son are the best of friends. They never fight yet and are always together. They play all the normal kid make-believe stuff, but sometimes they play We're Getting Married or This Is Boyfriend, and it just keeps me out of my skin. Is this normal play, or should I be dropping them off for some inpatient therapy? We keep all media very G-rated, and the YouTube Kids app is heavily monitored when they're using it. Any advice? How should I be reacting to this?
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
How should she be reacting to this? Should she be signing her kids up for some form of intensive, probably Freudian therapy? What do you think?
No, not yet. 5 and 7, were those the ages?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, like, I don't, it seems pretty normal that a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old are going to like want to play out, you know, some things that they see in the adult world that they think grown-ups do. Now I'm going to work. This is my house. This is my husband. This is my boyfriend. Like, that doesn't in and of itself seem weird. So I don't know that the kids are indicating anything that makes you feel like you need to take them to therapy. I do understand, however, that it, in the adult imagination, that like brings up things that we find super uncomfortable. But that's, you have to separate your imagination out from the kid's actions. That's kind of a general rule I have about parenting, because kids do a simple action and I then imagine all kinds of terrible things as a result. And if I believe too heavily in my imagination, then I act regrettably as a parent, like usually overreact or whatever. So I think it's fine. I think you keep an eye on it. I think most kids sort of naturally figure out where the line is. They don't even have the desire to cross it. So I don't think you need to assume that you need to intervene. But I know with our kids, I don't remember how we did. My kids are of 2.5 years apart, a boy and a girl. And definitely at some point, the conversation casually happened, like, well, you don't marry your sister. You're not boyfriends with your brother. That's something that people don't do, right? Like, and I don't remember how that came up, but it sort of casually came up. It didn't seem like they struggled with that concept. It didn't seem like they pushed back against it. I thought it was helpful to establish that those are the rules that we operate by as a society. But I also didn't feel like it was necessary in the sense that, like, if we didn't tell them, they would go this other direction. And I think that's a general thing that I think, and other people may feel differently, that we don't, it's not like we have to prevent incest in some kind of like direct way. I think it generally doesn't really happen in normal, healthy families. And so I don't think you need to be overly proactive or preemptive about it. I think if it's uncomfortable, you keep an eye on it and you see if anything, any kind of exploration or play is happening. That makes either of the kids uncomfortable, that makes you uncomfortable, and then maybe you could have a conversation to find out more about it.
I think that's exactly right. I think, as you said, this is a case of kids playing a game of replicating adult relationships, right? This is, they see what adults are doing, and they do that in their play. That's a totally standard thing. And they're using the tools they have available. They're using the available resources, which in this case is their sibling. Right. If you are a 7-year-old girl and you're playing at home with you and you don't have any friends over and you want to play house, then the available resources are your 5-year-old brother. And like, there you go. So he's going to be the husband and I'm going to be the wife. He's going to be the dad. I'm going to be the mom. And look, we're playing. We're being a family. This is not about a like attraction between the two children. This is about a game of replicating adult relationships. I know when I talked to my daughter at one point and we were talking about growing up and someday you'll grow up and maybe you'll be a mommy if you want to be a mommy and won't that be fun? And she said, I want to be a mommy and great. And she said, who's going to be the daddy? And I said, well, whoever you choose. And she said, maybe Leo, meaning her younger brother, because, that's all she can think of. She's trying to replicate her family. She likes her family. She likes living in a house with me and her mom and her brother. And so she's going to do that. And I said, well, actually, you can't really do that. And she said, okay, it's just you have to explain the rules to them a little bit. And then she understands and they can still play at it. This all seems fine. There are obviously like forms of play that you might want to discourage. If you caught them playing doctor, I think that would be like totally normal, like the curiosity about the body of the other gender or whatever, completely normal. If you want to, you could probably discourage that. You probably shouldn't like punish it or be super harsh on it. But even that would be totally normal. And then there are kinds of play that you would want to say, whoa, no, we don't do that. And that's not allowed and whatever. It's all growing up and figuring this stuff out. And I think the idea that, I guess this is what you were saying, the idea that a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old should already know all of these rules, that doesn't seem like a fair expectation to put on them. Like, no, they don't know the rules. You have to like explain to them how all this stuff works.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to recommendations. Carvel, do you have anything to recommend?
Yeah, I do. So this one, a lot of these recommendations, I have to reach back into the archives because my kids are too old for any parenting right now. They don't need me. Dad, I don't need you. You don't understand. But when they were little kids, we had to do a lot of intervention. And one thing I was remembering that we did for like maybe 6 months or a year, and it worked super well, was what we called the story timer. And the story timer is a response to the fundamental issue of having siblings, which is that they are in constant competition for the attention and affection of the parent or parents. And one of the ways this played out in our household is that kids would use their talking time at the dinner table to subconsciously or subliminally dominate the other child. So they would open up long, rambling stories, knowing good and well that the other kid was waiting for a chance to speak. And then they would keep adding long clauses onto the stories and like going off on bizarre tangents. And then if the other kid tried to interrupt, they would then try and like use the no interrupting rule to hold the floor. It was
Your
really brilliant.
Your kids are so smart. Yeah.
They're like filibustering. It was like filibustering. That's really what it was. Like the kids used to filibuster. And so we had to introduce, because we had the no interrupting rule, and that was something that we were clear about: when another person's talking, you don't interrupt them. You let them finish their thought, you listen to them, and then you respond. And like they, of course, use that to basically jab at each other throughout dinner. And so we started this thing called the story timer, where basically as soon as a kid was like about to tell a story, they would have to announce they were going to tell a story, and then we would set the timer. And I think for a while we had 3 minutes, and then sometimes we would do 5 minutes. And it wasn't every time the kid started talking, but part of my job is like the sort of conversation moderator was to be like, this sounds like a story. This is when they were like maybe 7 through 10. This sounds like a story. Do you think the story timer would be helpful here? And they usually are like, okay, fine. So then we put in the story timer, and it's like 2 minutes to 3 minutes to tell it. And what I found that was amazing about it is that how not only did it help them become aware of the fact that conversation is a give and take, not just a take and take, but it also started helping them, I think, really organize the important parts of their story.
Wow.
And I think it like helped them start to think about how do you communicate? Like, how do you get to the point? Because so many times when my kids are talking, and maybe you guys are thinking this right now, so many times when my kids are talking, I'm like, what's the point? Get to the point, right? And I'm sure they get that from me. But the story timer is super awesome because I think it helps kind of organize some of their thinking. And who knows, maybe later, like years later when they take the SAT or whatever, like essay stuff, they'll be able to call on those skills. So I recommend the story timer. We used it kind of at will with the permission of the kids. We set stories for 3, maybe 5, sometimes 7 minutes if it felt it was going to be a long one. And it also helped the other kid know that their time was coming up. They just had to wait out the timer.
Did the kids ever hear you or their mother start a story and try to turn the story timer back on you? My kids definitely, when they hear me revving up a story, they would definitely want to use the story timer on me.
No, that never happened. But if they did, that would be great, because then you could be like, good, I'll do the story timer. And then, you know, you just get to your point.
Yeah, that is great. I'm definitely going to do this. I have a recommendation. It's not nearly as good as the story timer. I have a recommendation that I want to qualify very, very strongly by saying that this is very useful to solve a certain highly specific problem. The highly specific problem that I was facing was, we listen to music on Spotify, and it's great because you have all the music. You don't have to like buy the record that they want to hear or whatever. So if they want to hear the soundtrack from Moana, we can listen to the soundtrack from Moana obsessively for a month and then not listen to it again. So Leo, 2.5, almost 3, really will want to hear, let's say, The Wheels on the Bus, or really will want to hear She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain. And if you type The Wheels on the Bus into the Spotify search field, there are like 1,000 versions of The Wheels on the Bus, and all of them are by people usually in like former Soviet states with a Casio keyboard doing just appalling versions of The Wheels on the Bus that like they're getting, you know, $3 out of making this version of The Wheels on the Bus, and it takes them 10 minutes. And listening to those renditions of these already annoying songs, listening to these tinny, horrible versions of annoying songs, like it can drive you insane. And then you say, no, we can't listen to Wheels on the Bus. And then he gets mad because she got to listen to what she wants. Why can't I listen to Wheels on the Bus? Whatever. The solution to this highly specific problem, my recommendation, is Laurie Berkner's favorite classic kids' songs. It's an album. It's got like 60 songs. It has The Wheels on the Bus. It has She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain. It has every song your kid is going to request. But they're very pleasant arrangements, very wholesome instrumentation, and she has a lovely voice, and they're thoughtfully harmonized. And it's actually quite nice to listen to a pleasant arrangement of Wheels on the Bus in a sort of contemporary folk style. So save that as a playlist or whatever, Laurie Berkner's favorite classic kids songs, and then you never have to listen to these awful Yugoslavian versions of The Wheels on the Bus. That's my recommendation. We'll link to it on our show page, which we will post on our Facebook page from one page to another. Okay. That's it for our show. It has been a pleasure talking to you, Carvel. Listeners, if you have any questions that you'd like us to answer, email them to momanddad@slate.com or post them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddad, or call into our voicemail at 424-255-7833, and then we won't have to get a Slate staffer to read your letter. 424-255-7833 if you want to hear your voice on the podcast. I have some exciting news, which is that this podcast will be back next week and every week thereafter. That's right, we're going to a weekly schedule. I will be back in 1 week with Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie. Send us questions and topics that you would like to hear us discuss. I hope you're as excited about this as we are. If you're not, you can skip every other episode and it'll be just like it was before. Mom and Dad Are Fighting was produced by Zach Dinerstein. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and June Thomas is the managing producer. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is a production of the Panoply Network, of which Andy Bowers is the chief content officer. I'm Gabriel Roth, and we'll be back next week.
And the wheels on the bus go round and